It is Monday, March 29th, 2021. This is LA Podcast with Hayes Davenport, Scott Frazier, Alyssa Walker. We have an interview this week, and it's with Cerise Castle again. She's back. She's back. And she is talking about an incredibly reported, comprehensive series that she has written for Knock LA, some installments of which have already been released, more are continuing to come out, called A Tradition of Violence, A History of Deputy Gangs in the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, something that we have talked about a lot on this show, but which I've learned an astonishing amount about from reading this series, and I know many listeners have as well.
In our interview, I call it long-form journalism, which feels diminutive.
Yeah.
It is
it's very close to being a book.
I was going to say, if like me, you keep a journal of books that you read throughout the year, then like me, you should add A Tradition of Violence once you finish it, because it really does have the weight and depth of a book. It is so thorough, and we're really excited to have Cerise back on to talk about it.
And before that, we're only going to talk about one thing, which is this week, the encampment of unhoused people, the community at Echo Park Lake, which had been there, well, it's been there in one form or another for years, but had sort of taken a new form in the last year that we've talked about a lot on this show, of actively like participating in the political advocacy of its own right to be in the park. As pretty much everyone listening probably knows, because it became national news, the lake was shut down this week. It was enclosed by a fence, and every person living at the lake was removed in one way or another. Many were moved into transitional housing of various types. Many just like went out to other, like stayed on the street, went out to other parts of the city. And at the very end of the saga, a couple of people were arrested. Simultaneous with that, hundreds and hundreds of LAPD officers in riot gear were released onto the street to form skirmish lines against protesters and enable the process of this park closing and these individuals being removed. I think we want to start by just kind of going day by day, and then I want to talk about personal experiences with it, because we were all there at different points. Scott and Alyssa were there at some of the most intense moments.
Together.
We were. We saw each other in person.
Very jealous. Scott's
so easy to find. He's so tall.
It's true. I always can find Scott. It started when we were recording last week. I remember the rumors of it had just kind of started coming out. So it was one week ago today, Sunday, that people were starting to hear that the park was maybe going to be closed. And at the time, there was no kind of set date on it necessarily. There were different dates that Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, something like that. And I think that is a testament to kind of the fundamental nature of what was like very unusual. Like encampments have been cleared all over the city for years and years and years, but an entire park closure of this scale being a rumor 3 days before it happened is incredibly rare. As far as I know, is like basically unprecedented, right?
I mean, I have never seen anything like this. As someone who covers all sorts of public space and construction and city infrastructure issues, especially when you compare it to what you have to do to, like, construct a small three-story building in a neighborhood like Echo Park, for example, and the type of outreach that you have to do, and who you're supposed to tell which streets are closing and when and how long the project is going to go. And from the beginning, It was reported out almost to exact detail by Ben Oreskes, and I don't know who else is on that first story. Was
Doug Smith?
Doug Smith,
I think,
who had just covered a wedding that had happened in the park within this community the week before, which is just was really just one more,
which really pissed off Mitch O'Farrell,
yeah,
apparently.
Yeah, yeah.
That they did cover that.
Yeah. So basically, it was reported exactly what was going to happen. And then every other journalist, there was a bunch of, follow up from particularly Kate Cagle from Spectrum, asked Mitch O'Farrell point blank, here's this story. It says it's closing Thursday. He has a camera on his face. This was on Tuesday that she did this interview?
No.
Wednesday.
This was on Wednesday.
Wednesday.
Was hours before the notices
Tuesday. Mm-hmm. And then this was on Wednesday, right. And he just kind of looks at the camera and kind of, smiles and refuse. Some you could say refuse to confirm, or you could just basically say he's straight up lied about the fact that it was going to happen the very
next
day.
I'll say he straight up lied. I mean...
First he disparaged the LA Times reporting.
And then, the other part.
He said, I don't know where they got their sources, but he said that their reporting on this issue has like implied that it was
been
not
doing curious reporting.
Curious reporting
on this issue. And that's why I'm saying, in particular, mm-hmm. he seems to have been mad about the Oreskes and Smith reports, about the commune-like atmosphere at the park, the reporting on the marriage taking place as reports of the upcoming midnight raids spread. All of that seems to have really, really irked the council member. He called it curious. He seemed to imply that people shouldn't believe anything that they had to say on the topic. And then, like Kay said, several hours later, of course, they were confirmed. Yeah, almost to the letter.
And now let's talk about Councilmember O'Farrell's role in this going back for a very long time at Echo Park Lake. He represents Echo Park Lake, and his office is one of his field offices is two blocks away from the lake. And the very adversarial relationship between the council member and the residents of the lake and the organizers who work alongside the people that were living at the lake is one of the big narratives of this whole story over the last couple years now. And he has attempted at various points or been associated with attempts to clear out the lake for different reasons. It was in January of 2020 that there was a film permit for a Nike commercial posted that was going to require people to leave the lake. That ended up being protested, and the various film production companies said that they didn't need that part of the lake, and so everyone ended up staying for that one. Mm-hmm. There have been other attempts at different degrees of sweeps, cleanups. People have been arrested at the lake in the past. It's been a really, really drawn out, contentious process. And in this case, it's pretty clear at this point, as kind of admitted and even seemingly bragged about by the council member, that this was the lake closure, the closure of the entire park for that reason was kept completely under wraps, was done with zero transparency because he did not want anyone to know. He did not want this to leak. He did not want it to get out. I know within City Hall, there was no communication with other colleagues, other departments. UHRC, the Unified Homelessness Response Center, which was set up by the mayor's office to be representatives from the state, the county, a bunch of different departments on homelessness, they found out with incredibly little advance notice that this park closure was happening, and they found out from animal control. So this was this is what I have been, the sources say. And so this was entirely a individual effort, but I want to flash forward to Wednesday night when the notice was actually posted that the park was being closed. There were what drew a lot of protesters to the site first and kind of confirmed that this was happening, because I don't think it was an absolute certainty to pretty much anyone in the city until 60 cop cars showed up and staged at Dodger Stadium. Mm-hmm. And then there was kind of like this confirmation that, okay, like this is happening now. And that by the end of their varying estimates of how many police were actually involved as the site was being closed, the notice was posted and the fences started going up immediately. I've seen estimates of as many as 400 police. That is not something that Councilmember O'Farrell is able to just snap his fingers and do.
They were from all over the city.
Yes.
All over the city.
I've heard people say that, like, issues that they were dealing with that had police involvement were delayed because everyone was dedicated towards this park, this completely unannounced park closure. And that's not just Mitch O'Farrell doesn't just, like, say, like, hey, I need 400 cops right here for this. It's my personal opinion that that cannot happen without the collaboration and support of Mayor Garcetti. And
I don't see how it could. I don't see how it could.
That's just not the way power works in the city. And so
we also, I also want to say, haven't heard a word from council member, council president Nuri Martinez.
Only council members Rahman, Bonin, and Ridley Thomas have spoken up about the actual park closure. Councilmember De Leon talked about what happened as a result of the police intervention, including multiple journalists being arrested, which we talk about also with Cerise Castle.
Councilmember Buscaino as well.
Councilmember Buscaino spoke up to say that every resident, this was around like Thursday morning, Thursday afternoon, that every resident of the park had been housed, which was not true at the time, never ended up being true.
He spoke up to say in agreement with what, I mean, he managed to say what it took Mitch O'Farrell, I think, an additional 48 hours to say, which was that this should be a model for housing unhoused people going forward.
And Garcetti ended up saying that as well. And I do want to talk about the narratives that are kind of playing out in different places after this. But I also want the two of you who on Wednesday and Thursday, I was there Wednesday night. I wasn't in the kind of the scrum, which was blocked off by the time I got there. Scott, you were, and I want to hear like from your and Alyssa's experience on Wednesday and Thursday night about what happened.
Sure. To start with Wednesday morning, when I did see you, Hayes, and we were there together for a while, but Wednesday morning, everybody turned out. As you mentioned, there was a lot of confusion, intentional, about when exactly the park closure was going to begin, when the sweep was going to happen, when the what ended up being the middle of the night raids were going to happen. There was a lot of concern Wednesday morning because there was this big call to come out. We had originally heard that Wednesday the park would be closed, ended up being true, and that people should be there Wednesday morning to show support and solidarity with the community that has been living there for quite some time, has been requesting to speak with Mitch O'Farrell's office unsuccessfully for quite some time. That happened. Lots of people turned up. There was a press conference given at which the unhoused residents who were still there at that time, numbering at least in the dozens, gave their perspective on what exactly had been happening, the fact that they were being arbitrarily forced out by a council member with an agenda to push, with a specific grievance and desire to exact revenge, in my opinion, over a community that had bested him last year. So once everybody left, you know, they told people after the sign making, after the walk to Mitch O'Farrell's office two blocks away where nobody was, that people should go home and rest, and if they felt comfortable so doing, come back in the evening and make plans to spend the night at the park in order to prevent what was perceived at that point to be an early morning raid on Thursday. So about Wednesday at, let's say, 7 p.m., word started getting out that Hayes, as you mentioned, several dozen, as many as 60 cop cars were staging at the police academy. And so when that happened, there was a request for everybody who was available to make their way to the lake. Those cop cars eventually started leaving Elysian Park, leaving the Dodger Stadium area and making their way towards Echo Park. And by about 8 p.m., there were dozens, if not hundreds, of cops present at the lake. This was a major operation where we are talking about every side of Echo Park Lake closed off by police, cordons and roadblocks put up on the streets that run adjacent to the park. The Glendale Boulevard exit from the 101 was closed. We had deployments of cops from West Division, from Harbor Division. We had all of those coordinated movements happening so that they would arrive there at approximately 8 p.m. Now, again, the public hours of the park have it being open until 10:30. There were no notices posted that the park was going to be closing by that period in time. So I arrived at about 8:45 p.m., and I was on the northwest corner of Echo Park at Park in Glendale. I actually did an Instagram live from our Instagram account for the podcast for a little bit. And they were not letting anybody cross Glendale Boulevard. Glendale Boulevard was entirely closed down from the 101 freeway up past the Sunset Overpass. They wouldn't tell people why the closure was in effect. At one point, I was told it is closed because it's closed. The sidewalks were closed. People who lived in the neighborhood were not allowed to use the sidewalk to get to their homes. And there were, at that point, there was already a skirmish line deployed facing Park Avenue. So this is far, again, far from the actual boundary of the park. So after a while there, I was told by a journalist, a friend of the show, Melissa Batchelor-Warnke, that they were not prepared to address the press in any way. They didn't have a public information officer. They were telling press that they should move from their location, which was on the side of Glendale Boulevard, to up past Park and Glendale, far again from the park location. But there was no press officer. We had a deployment of, I would say, between 200 and 400 police officers, and none of them were authorized to speak to the press about what was going on. And so that was the situation at about 8:45 to 9 p.m. From there, I think I'm getting ahead of myself, because Alyssa, you were actually there earlier, right?
Yeah, I was there. I got there like right as the sun was going down, and I rode a metro bike over. Metro bike was a great tool for protest hopping in this instance, until they put the metro bike station behind the police line, and I had to give my bike to a cop to return my bike. A different story. But I got there just as the sun was going down, and I'm so naive. Like, I just thought that like some road closures happened to be happening because they were so far away from the actual lake that I was like, oh, that can't be related. And then you started to see the trucks of the fencing, these big rented trucks, stacked, you know, two times as high as the truck, just started rolling in and going to that far corner, like the Bellevue Echo Park Boulevard corner of, or the, yeah, Bellevue, right by the 101. And yeah, because that's where they started building the fence. So it was so fast, like when the police cars started to arrive, and like you said, they kind of went on the four corners of the park. There were buses were detoured. I don't even know where the buses went. Like, how do you get a metro bus that's coming up Glendale right there? They must have they must have sent them down Bellevue. I mean, I don't even know. There are people that were like,
I took the bus, so I can tell you. Yeah. I can tell you exactly what they did. They forced the buses either on to park. In one case, I saw from a bus coming south on Glendale, the bus that I was on Sunset was forced to detour onto Alvarado. Going where? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, completely disruptive. I mean, it was just so fast. And again, just to reiterate something we'll keep talking about. The people who lived in the neighborhood thought that someone had been, the people I talked to, so many people over the 2 nights, they thought that there had been like a murder. They thought that there had been some kind of like a terrorism type situation. There were all these people who were so confused about what happened. And they went to bed at night on Wednesday night because the helicopters did not stop for like 24 hours. I mean, it was constant, at least 4 or 5 in the sky. Pretty much for the entire 2 days, they went to bed thinking that something really wrong had gone on, something wrong was going on. But if you look on Nextdoor, it's all these people who are terrified, who had no idea what was happening, even in their own neighborhood.
So, Alyssa. So, I mean, all this to say, the cordons were up, the police line was up around the park in its entirety by about 8:30, 8:45, which was when I arrived. And Alyssa was inside that line. I was on the outside of it. And it was, for a long time, really not clear if anybody who was outside of it was going to be able to get inside. We were able to actually get to where the rest of the protesters were, where the rest of the residents were, by going around on Bonnie Bray to Montrose. And there was a police line, but it was inattentive, I suppose, is the word I would use. So we were able to get past that line and actually make it to where the protesters were lining up. Again, everything that was happening Thursday night to a really great extent was happening at the direction of the unhoused residents. You know, the protesters were really trying to be respectful of the folks who live there and, you know, making sure that we stayed together as a group, lined up, were peaceful, et cetera. All of that was happening in spite of the escalatory tactics of the police at the request of the unhoused residents. It was quite a contrast. In my view, and so when I got within the limits of the police barricades, I met up with Alyssa, and we were at that point facing a skirmish line of police again. This time it was facing north on Glendale Boulevard at about Santa Ynez. And how many people would you say were there? How many protesters would you say were there, Alyssa?
I guessed about 200.
That sounds right.
I don't know if that's accurate. I felt good at counting people.
Wednesday night and also Thursday night, like there were very likely more cops than protesters.
Oh, for sure. Definitely more. Yeah, definitely more cops. And in riot gear from the beginning, pretty much.
So I was at the front of that line with the people who were willing to be arrested if it came to that, obviously hoping that it wouldn't, feeling very much like there was no reason for it to come to that. And what I saw was there was one officer in front of me to my right who was repeatedly making intentionally violent gestures with his baton. They all had their batons out. When the second line of cops came, they had their so-called less lethal weaponry unholstered, including, I mean, this, it was just a few weeks ago, just like 2 weeks ago, that we talked about the independent report from the May and June protests of last year saying that many of these weapons have no place being used in crowd control, but LAPD is still using them for that purpose, apparently. And so one of the the things that I saw on Wednesday night was this particular cop whose name is Alvin Clark break someone's bone, like just, you know, a few feet away from me. When they gave the order to push their skirmish line forward, you know, most of the cops are, they're being bullies. They're shoving hard with their batons. They're holding them, though, in a horizontal fashion and sort of making sweeping gestures. The effect is people get pushed off their feet. It's dangerous. And it was intentionally, as I said, escalatory in nature. But this one police officer in particular, as he had done several times up to that point, was really winding up, swinging his arm and his baton back and jabbing it in at the person who was in front of him. And watching that happen, he really was beating in at this person. And their arm was broken. They were taken to the emergency room that night and posted images on social media of their broken arm. I also want to say the LAPD has lied multiple times in the past several days about there having been no injuries and no use of force by their officers. No reports of injuries, which is just blatantly a falsehood. It was also repeated by Mitch O'Farrell, who added to it by incorporating a new lie, which was that it was the violence was incurred by the actions of the protesters. So I have been dismayed by the response of council member O'Farrell's office, because the lies that have come out have been really, really bald and really, really just incredibly blatant. So from that point, after this man whose name is Isaac had his arm broken, the protesters continued to hold their position. But it became pretty clear after the dispersal order was given that there was not much to be gained that evening. We got news while we were on the line that there were council members attempting to call Chief Moore, and given the media presence, trying to get across the message that this shouldn't be happening right now. And eventually, we also heard throughout the crowd that everyone who wanted to stay at the park by request of Lhasa was going to be given an additional 24 hours and not be arrested that night. So then the unhoused residents, again, in what I can only describe as a spirit of immense generosity to the city leaders who were forcing them out of where they live, they told everyone, you know, tonight is a victory. Nobody else needs to get hurt. Nobody needs to get arrested. Let's just call it a night and go home.
I want to supplement the thought about like generosity to city leaders. That was, as anytime you're bringing hundreds of police officers into the same environment as a group of unhoused people, an incredibly dangerous situation. And to defuse it at that moment from some of the leaders and spokespeople of the encampment was also a way to keep people safe.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know necessarily what their motives were, but that to me is a compelling one.
Yeah, I mean it's really dramatic when you have Councilmember Mitch O'Farrell repeatedly slandering these people. Calling them dangerous, going to NBC and like having them zoom in on images of guns and whatever and being like, look why I wouldn't come talk to these people. Look how dangerous they are. Look how much better it is now that they're not here. The really disgusting attempts to criminalize an entire community and suggest that they deserve whatever it is that he decides to do to them. That contrast is really dramatic when, if you, like I was, you were on the front line as Queen, one of the unhoused residents at the lake, took a megaphone and was saying, you know, like it or not, these cops are here doing their jobs. We're going to do what we're here to do. But like, you know, to say that to a group of protesters who are obviously not disposed to looking favorably on what this riot squad of cops is there to do takes bravery. Like there was nothing forcing Queen to get up in that moment and say that. Nothing forcing Iman, another unhoused resident, to get up and tell people it's time to call it a night. You can go home. They did that because that's who they are, and that's what they believe, and because they want to keep people safe from police violence whenever they can. And the response of the city was, as soon as the protesters had dispersed, they started fencing in the remaining people who live there. So when people woke up Thursday morning, the remaining tenants at the lake, the remaining residents there, were effectively fenced in. They were basically in an open air prison. So Thursday, Hayes, you came out too. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, I was out on Thursday. It started as an organized peaceful vigil for the residents of the lake and for the kind of the community itself. On Sunset Boulevard and Lemoyne, where people blocked off the street, they sat kind of in silence in the street starting around 5-6 p.m. And that also led to or brought out a really significant police presence. The group kind of ended up splitting into one that kind of just like remained in the street and was surrounded. All groups were surrounded by police officers, and one that formed a skirmish line with police officers. In that second group, the group was kettled, according to LAPD, because one person in the crowd had a flashing strobe light, and the officers declared an unlawful assembly, told everyone to leave the premises, and then shortly after that declared that nobody would be allowed to leave the premises and that everyone was going to be arrested. There were, I think, about 180 arrests that night, including 12 journalists. Alyssa, do you want to talk about the experiences of some of those journalists?
Well, yeah, that was the announcement they made was very specific, and I haven't heard this one as much, but they said everyone has to leave, including journalists and legal observers.
And, yes, who were also arrested in large numbers.
Who were also arrested. And that announcement right away was like, well, that's kind of a twist on your normal unlawful assembly announcement. I was just outside, just to the west of where it was happening. You know, I wasn't getting trapped inside. But from what the journalists were saying that were in there, and, you know, they have eyes on each other. When you're in the situation, you kind of try to look to the side and see who you're setting up your shot next to or something like that. So they all knew what was happening, and they all said it was very clear that they were targeted. And in one case, the police officer said, like, this is the plan for tonight or something like that.
This is the policy. That's according to LA Times reporter James Squealy, who was arrested and who was detained and then released after, I think, about 40 minutes after outcry from the LA Times. But some reporters, we'll talk about this, reporters for organizations like Knock LA were booked. Yeah.
And it was, you can watch some of the videos. It was so funny because we talked last week about James and Kevin Rector's story about Lex's Olivia Ray, about how he had gotten this city attorney letter about after the after being, because he didn't disperse after when he was covering the Dodger celebration downtown. They had a moment where they talked about on Twitter, and then in that a story about James getting arrested, where they kind of were like, oh my gosh, is this really going to happen? And it did happen. They both got grabbed. And you have to just wonder how closely were they watching the journalists and deciding who to pick out of the crowd and trying to send a very, very specific message, I felt, by what they did. I mean, Kate Cagle from Spectrum News was setting up her shot to go live with a microphone in her hand, and they pull her away and detain her. I mean, it's pretty chilling what happened and that they did it so blatantly. And the legal observers too. I mean, these people have like bright neon green hats. If you've been to a protest, it's very obvious. These people don't get detained at these situations. That's when I started to get really scared and tried to go find out, where they were getting taken to. And they did let a lot of people go, but you're right. Like it's this whole question too about like, who do you have there to advocate for you? And who is considered to be, an actual member of the press? And there's all these questions about credentials and, you know, what you should have. And it was pretty messed up.
And so then the following morning, the two remaining residents of the park, Ayman Ahmed and David Bush Lilly, who, like, some people over the course of Thursday night had accepted transitional housing and were brought there. Some just dispersed into the community. Some were given hotel rooms by Ground Game LA. Ayman Ahmed and David Bush Lilly stayed in the park overnight. They live streamed most of the night and then were arrested around 10:30 the next morning. They were brought to Metro Detention Center, but were not booked. Were just released. And then the park was empty. The reporting throughout, I mean, I think there was a lot of amazing reporting, present company included. Alyssa wrote just a beautiful piece for Curbed in New York Magazine about the kind of the whole course of events over the week. Ben Oreskes was in the park for hours and hours and hours documenting what was happening. Emily Alpert Reyes, Libby Denkman, the aforementioned reporters who ended up being detained. What we've talked about on the show, there was a lot of like great solidarity, I think, among journalists, but also were like documenting what was happening as accurately as possible. We talked about already in this episode, this has now been framed as a big success by Councilmember O'Farrell, Mayor Garcetti, other elected officials. Councilmember O'Farrell sent out an email and a Twitter thread celebrating that they had put 200 plus individuals into transitional housing and disparaging other elected officials. He said, referring to Councilmembers Rahman, Bonin, and Ridley Thomas, presumably, who had called out what was happening, said, "I'm disappointed that some local elected officials, valuing politics over finding real housing solutions in their own districts," that's all in bold, "have sought to mischaracterize our successful work to house people. They have also wrongly conflated our efforts to house individuals with our larger conversations about police reform. In addition to misleading people, this rhetoric does a great disservice to Angelenos, both unhoused and housed, and it needs to stop." And, you know, that conflation of police show of force,
yeah,
and housing, right, and moving unhoused people into shelter, that conflation happened. Mitch O'Farrell did that. Mitch, yeah, O'Farrell brought those,
yeah,
the,
yeah,
those concepts into the same geographic area and had one enforce the process of the other happening.
Mm-hmm.
This has been like a really, really tragic week, and I would love to say that I see like a clear way forward after this, but like for the lake was the first place I ever did outreach. It was my route. That was in 2017. It was my route for like a year and a half. Every person that I was involved in the process of housing them. I met there almost every person I have known and worked with through outreach who has died was from there or in the surrounding area and like Glendale Boulevard and Alvarado. I remember when at the end of 2019, when Ayman Ahmed and a couple other individuals like showed up at the park and kind of changed the character of it and turned it into more of a community and got more active in defending the park. And you know, over COVID, I was not doing outreach. I wasn't visited a couple times, but like not as actively. And but you know, there has been kind of a, you've been able to follow what's happened at the park along semi like political trends. And for whatever reason, Councilmember O'Farrell, Mayor Garcetti, and others that were involved in this, I think believe that this was a politically advantageous thing to do.
Totally.
And what we're witnessing, I thought the LA Times actually covered this really well in their most recent article about the lake, is a completely bifurcated response to what happened, both sides of which are driven primarily by anger. There's the people who are furious about O'Farrell's total lack of transparency in executing this process, sending in so many police, the violence, the violent atmosphere in which it took place, the rushed nature of the service provision, which drove people to, there were lots of broken promises about where people would be sheltered and for how long because it was so rushed. The damage to service provision is incalculable,
mm-hmm.
in terms of like what people will trust. What kinds of programs people will fight for. I've seen advocates just like abandoning Project Room Key as an idea.
Yeah.
Because it was connected to.
Right.
It enabled the process of shutting down this. It was used.
Right.
As like as
a sledgehammer,
like, yeah. as a sledgehammer, yeah. to like to grease the process of, yeah. Closing the park. And the other side of this bifurcated response is people who are saying all over the city, oh, why can't we do that here? Like this was good. This should have happened a long time ago.
Including, I just want to say people who think that this response shouldn't have happened to Echo Park, the community, yes. at Echo Park, which has sort of been held out as an example of a really peaceful encampment. Obviously, as I said just a few minutes ago, Mitch O'Farrell has been doing a lot of counter-propagandizing in order to mm-hmm. make it seem like Echo Park was exceptionally dangerous. But throughout the city, people who have said, oh, I think it's terrible what they did at Echo Park because of the nature of that community, are actually saying, but my encampment near my house should have that exact thing happen, that the police come in and break it up,
yes,
and all that.
Absolutely. And Echo Park Lake, that community was not an ideal environment, and like no experience of homelessness is. And homelessness is an incredibly individualized experience, and there's no like, oh, this is the perfect way for homelessness to happen. Oh, this is the perfect kind of solution for it. Like, it is different for every single individual. And this, the blunt and sudden nature of this has calcified everyone's perspective on what is supposed to happen with homelessness, and years of work attempting to build consensus around the approach to this problem has been detonated.
Yep. And I think that what we can really see is like, sorry, I cut you off, but I feel like what we're seeing is, yes, that consensus is out the window. What has been a growing sense that like there are reasons why existing approaches haven't been working, and they are tied to lack of trust. These types of actions, the use of force to compel people to accept things that they don't have a historical reason to believe will actually be in their long or even medium term benefit to accept. All of those things, Mitch O'Farrell, Joe Buscaino, Mike Feuer, people like them are taking the very hard tack the very hard turn of now saying we are there, it is not incumbent upon us to listen to homeless people when they tell us what will help them. We set the boundaries and parameters for this discussion and for all of the solutions, and anyone who doesn't like it can go to jail or onto the streets.
Can literally go to jail. Can you either be fenced in or fenced into a park overnight and brought out of the park one by one in the morning and basically been banished to some motel either far from your home or put into a shelter, or you actually will go to jail. There was really no, and if you speak up about it, or you, I mean, the narrative of these people, whatever Mitchell Farrell said in his statement, and I saw it too. I caught him in that alley outside of his office Thursday morning, yeah, giving like a pep talk to all the people that were about to go in there and
yeah, Alyssa,
and displaced.
Can I just stop down for a second? My brilliant friend Alyssa, twice I was just astonished at what you were able to report and so ingeniously. Prior to that, I can't believe we forgot this. You were one of the first people to basically confirm that the park was closing because you booked a swan boat ride for the following day and then received a notification before anyone in the city announced that this was happening, that your swan boat ride was canceled.
Was canceled. Before Mitchell Farrell actually acknowledged that the park was closing, the swan boats sent me a text message. I was standing right next to Scott, actually, when it happened. It came through like we were the riot cops were like advancing on us, and then I get a notification on my phone. And also calling the rec center. I called the rec center, and the person who answered the phone at the Echo Park rec center was like, "Of course the park is closing tomorrow, sweetie." You know,
But even they have misinformation. I heard them saying it would be closed for 15 days.
Somebody did say 15 days.
It would be closing at this time or that time. No one really knew what was going on.
No one knew. But to go back to, you know, what Mitchell Farrell was saying, like outside of his office that morning, you know, trying to really frame this as like, we're doing a great thing. You know, it's unfortunate that the mob, you know, caused this, you know, but just this idea that if you are showing up, this narrative that he was pushing in that morning too, is that if you are showing up to be angry or to say this isn't right or this isn't fair, that you are somehow impeding the service providers and caseworkers from doing their work, when in fact you pointed out the exact intersection where the vigil was being held at Lemoyne and between Sunset and the park. That's where people were coming out to get help all day, right? That's where if you came out of the park or if you needed to go back inside to get your belongings that were still there, that was kind of like the gateway to let people in and out of the park. So if you want to talk about who was stopping the help from being provided, that is where the police staged, climbed into people's yards. I mean, there were people, they were in like the people's, climbing onto private property so they could start their little squish of people into this, blocking off Sunset Boulevard into this zone of where they were going to make these mass arrests. And there were people still coming out of the park and trying to get their stuff that couldn't get help because of this staging, this military operation that was being staged right there. And I saw it. I saw that happen. So who, what narrative are they going to try to push? The people sitting on the ground singing are stopping help from being provided?
All of this, you've both alluded to it, and like Mitch O'Farrell has used, like has held up people who are homeless as like the victims of the protests. But I mean, honestly, like we like talking about this, the dynamic this has created, which has already led to escalating cries demanding enforcement and criminalization in other neighborhoods, which will be met with an escalating response from protesters. All of this creates just an unbelievably dangerous environment for people who are homeless. And I am very scared.
Yeah.
We have talked about in the past in different episodes about encampments being firebombed. And it was an encampment. I tell you, sometimes I go look at like other not my own like Twitter feed, just other like places on the internet. And there was a post on the LA Reddit about an encampment near Gold's Gym that had burned down. I don't know why it burned. It could have been a million different reasons. It was really windy that day. Sometimes like cooking fires like burn down an encampment. But, you know, it's a tragic photo of like people's this whole encampment and people's things just being like totally destroyed. And all the comments were fully dehumanized. No one saw this as like a tragic situation at all. They talked about, oh, well, now at least I won't get harassed on my way to the gym. Oh, where am I going to park today when I go there? We're just in like a very, very dangerous place. And I don't know. Like I think the project of rebuilding and trying to repair the damage that was wrought by this just kind of has to be done. I know there are some who are like, I don't think it's incorrect, who would say like, let's use this as an opportunity to like drive harder to like create like wedges against the existing system. But like, I don't know. I'm worried. People out there are feeling really violent, and this has just made everyone's work so much harder.
Yeah.
Final thoughts?
I mean, I alluded to it earlier. I really think, and I'm writing something for our blog that will touch on this as well, but I really think that what we see here is probably something that has its germination in the protests at Echo Park a year ago, which were a stinging rebuke by protesters, a large number of protesters, of exactly this kind of action being taken by Mitchell Farrell's office. I think that is exactly where the impetus for this came from. I think it's probably been close to a year in planning. And I agree, Hayes. I think that this type of thing, far from what people suggest online, that that protesters want these things to happen so they have something to protest, that activists are somehow lining their pockets. I mean, I personally can say that is just could not be further from the truth. We have a lot of people doing what they can to pitch in where needed, because they recognize that the people who are living unhoused in Los Angeles are multiply victims of the systems that are in place here, that are they are having to live 24/7 in fear of reprisals like this. So we're, as housed people, we're taking time and putting money towards trying to protect people, because it's unfair for them to have to bear so disproportionately the burdens that are placed on them by this city. It is incredibly devastating to everyone involved. It's devastating to people who are brutally assaulted by the police. It's devastating to people who witness others being brutally assaulted by the police. It's harmful to our sense of community as a whole. And I really just feel like whatever we do going forward as people who believe that the city has a duty to actually listen to and compassionately respond to the needs of homeless individuals here, it does require breaking down misconceptions about what exactly is the crisis here. Is the crisis that that there are poor people who live near you, or is the crisis that we can't adequately meet their needs? We can't commit to doing things that it takes to provide services to them on an ongoing basis. I agree with you, though, Hayes. I see those two sides getting further apart. And I find it really concerning as we go forward.
And one thing too about just the, you know, I went back Saturday morning, days mean nothing anymore. Saturday morning, there were probably about 50 police still around the lake. nothing had happened there for over 24 hours, really. You know, there were crews inside that were throwing things away. The playground across the street, the southern part of the park with the skate park and another playground was also fenced off. And when I tried to take some photos, I was yelled at by two cops on motorcycles that pulled up that told me to get on the other side of the street where there were a lot of people who had been living in the lake around the perimeter on that far sidewalk with belongings that they were trying to get back to people who hadn't made it back there yet, who were watching people's stuff and, you know, talk to them as I walked around. So this is what we live with now for the next few months, weeks. I mean, no one knows. The banners have no end date for the project on them that are hung up around the lake. And then what park is next? MacArthur Park, Venice Beach. I mean, Grand Park has been fenced off. Part of Grand Park has been fenced off since they removed the Black Unity Camp in September. This is how it goes now? I mean, if regardless of how you feel about where people should be allowed to live and under what circumstances, that alone should get you to a point where you are able to say something to and speak out about how wrong this is for the city to replicate this, which they are planning to do.
We got a lot left in this episode. Let's go to our interview, the return of Cerise Castle on LA Podcast.
Okay, back with us. Now we have an interview with Cerise Castle of Knock LA, an independent leftist publication here in Los Angeles covering all of the political goings on in the city and region. We're very happy to have Cerise back. It was just a couple weeks ago that we had her on to speak about her experience as a Black journalist in the city. Very much recommend that anyone who hasn't heard it go back and listen to that episode, which we'll post in our show notes as well. Today, we're talking with Cerise about an incredible piece of long-form journalism that she is actually still in the process of releasing for Knock. And that is called A Tradition of Violence. The History of Deputy Gangs in the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. Cerise, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me back. So soon.
So soon.
We were just talking about this. We were like, okay, so it's been 3 weeks since we did the last one. That really just doesn't feel right, given all, I mean, what feels like several months worth of events that have been crammed into the last month or so. Of course, there was a substantial amount of discussion about our last conversation with you. And then this week, on our pre-interview segment, we've exclusively talked about the goings-on at Echo Park Lake, where the LAPD was deployed, of course, to remove a homeless encampment there. And several of your colleagues for Knock were arrested and detained. That's a lot. It's a lot to process. But we knew, even going into this week, that we wanted to have you on to talk about this series. Can you tell us a little bit about the genesis for A History or A Tradition of Violence and how it came to be published in this enormous 13, right, part series for Knock?
Yeah, it's 13 for now, but, you know, the way that the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department carries on with killing people, it's now looking closer to 16.
Wow.
There's just been a wealth of information that has come out over the past week, and a complaint that was submitted by a deputy who is suing the county because of harassment he faced from the Bandidos gang came out this week, so that pretty much blew up the plan that we had for 13 parts. So it's going to be a lot longer now.
That came out the same day you released the first installment, right? It was like a couple hours later.
Yes.
What does that feel like? Are you like, shit? Or are you like, oh, I guess I'm like doing more of this? What is that emotional experience?
Well, to be honest, a lot of the information that was in the amended complaint I already had from different sources. So when I read it, I felt like, all right, cool, I'm on the right track. Everything that I've been doing is validated in this complaint. I wasn't really, I was kind of like excited, actually.
Do you have the same response that former Linwood deputy Deitch has, where he's just like, it's job
this
security.
This gives me job security.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
Oh man. I mean, I'd love if I didn't have to do this job anymore.
Yes, I think you probably have very few similarities with that particular individual.
So that line from that deputy is part of the story that you highlight in one of the pieces about Frankie Carrillo, who was falsely convicted of murder, spent two decades in prison, and largely because of the actions of one of these deputies, Deputy Deitch, who was a member of a deputy gang. And when Frankie Carrillo was released, Deputy Deitch said that, like, it doesn't matter that I think he was guilty. And the fact that he was released just gives me job security because bad guys will do bad stuff and I'll go catch him again, whatever. That story, like, I want to go back to Scott's question. This, we've talked a lot on the show about these deputy gangs, but there's an effect to having all these stories in one series. The effect is kind of punishing, honestly, to like go through like everything, like to try to like mainline it all at once is tough, but it just like what you've put together as reporting, because you do so many interviews, but also just as a history project, putting this all in one place, I think really brings out the different context, each story within context of other stories. But I am curious, like what Scott was kind of asking, is there one like that you remember as being kind of like an inciting incident for you that said, like, this is something that I want to pursue further?
Yeah, it's funny that you just likened it to a history project. I'm going to have to email my AP World History teacher after this and just be like, oh my God, remember those DBQs you kept shoving down my throat? Get a load of this one.
The blue bugs?
a little PTSD for all my AP kids. I mean, what started me on this project, honestly, was just like experiencing police violence firsthand myself. I grew up in LA County, and I've always heard from elders and from people in my social circle that the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department is the biggest gang in the county. And that was just sort of a reality that I accepted, as a child, really. And it's an expression that I carried into my adulthood. And you see evidence of that just based on how they treat, you know, low-income people of color. They constantly harass people, shoot people, beat people. So it's easy to see where they get that notion, where they get that nickname, rather. So I'd always been like sort of curious to know more about who exactly these gangs were, like what their names were, how they function since I was a small young person. I think I heard about the Vikings for the first time when I was like 12. From my older brother. And I was always just sort of like, wow, like a police gang, huh? Like, I wonder like where I can learn more about that, where I can read about that. That seems like something that, you know, people would study or write papers about. But no one ever did. And my whole life, I was just sort of like looking to read about that kind of stuff. I remember when I was in college, I like briefly thought, oh, maybe I can write about this for my thesis. And I went to the library and there was literally nothing about this. So it's always been something that's fascinated me. And I could never find anything to really satisfy my craving to learn about it. Last summer when I was covering the George Floyd protests, I was actually struck by a rubber bullet. I was shot by some law enforcement officer. It's unclear who they were or what branch they were affiliated with. That's something I'm still looking into. In any case, I was shot and I was hurt and I was on bed rest for like 6 months. I couldn't walk or really do anything. So what do nerds do when they can't leave the house? File CPRA requests. So I started
like any good journalist, like any good injured journalist would do.
Yeah. So I started filing PRA requests and I struck gold when I got a list that the county keeps of litigation related to deputy gangs. And it's a list of about 60 cases totaling about $55 million in settlement fees. And the list also names different deputy gangs that the deputies that were affiliated with in this incident are supposedly either associated with or members of. So I got this list and I got a list of like 18 gangs and I was like, holy shit, there's more here. So from that list, I just started researching all the different cases through public record. And I made my own little Pepe Silva push board with strings and everything. And from there, I was able to create and write 50 years of history of deputy gangs in Los Angeles County.
I have a lot of questions about this process because it's incredible. The effect of it, like Kays was saying, is truly astonishing. But first, I would like to just touch on the fact that apparently the county is keeping an ongoing tab for the lawsuits, the damages, the payouts, as if to say, like, you know, at a certain point, maybe this will become a problem. Like, it's we should just keep an eye on this for later. We're just going to let this run for decades, but maybe we want to do something about this down the line. Like, What were you when you made that request to the county or any of the requests that you were making? Did you actually think that there was an authoritative list like that, like it was known throughout the county exactly how many gangs there were, exactly how many cases? Because I'll be honest, my impression from existing reporting on it was sort of like, it was this diffuse problem that nobody really had the answers on outside of the sheriff's department. It seems like that's not the case, though.
Right. Yeah, that's definitely not the case. Local government, state government, federal government, they've heard about this problem dating back to at least the 1990s. So this is something that, you know, everyone has known about and no one has really done anything about. I wish I could say I was surprised that the county kept this list, but honestly, I wasn't. And, you know, in doing this research and learning about just how much the county knows and what they've let carry on while they have full knowledge of, like, the scope and breadth of this problem, I mean, I'm really not surprised. It seems like, I mean, just the way the county handles these cases, right? When a family loses a family member, and generally what happens is the district attorney will have the sheriff's department, the people that, you know, just killed their family member, will come and investigate the death, and they'll say, oh, you know, nothing went wrong here. Our guys were completely in policy and the DA will not file charges and the police officers are free to go on and, you know, live their lives, carry on their career. The family generally then will file a civil rights lawsuit against the county. And, you know, what the county does is they will hire these very litigious law firms to fight the families who are suing because their family member was just murdered, and they will have these years-long drawn-out fights in court where the county fights tooth and nail against paying off these people. I mean, the evidence that these law firms that the county hires that will introduce, like, it really just gives you an idea of, like, you know, how the county, like, views these things. Like, one thing that really sticks with me that I thought was particularly disgusting was a man who was unarmed, an unarmed black man who was killed by Los Angeles County Sheriff's deputies. Excuse me. He was killed by Los Angeles County Sheriff's deputies. And the deputies said that this man had a gun and that he had pointed the gun at the deputies and had attempted to kill them. There was no gun found on the scene until hours later. You know, they searched in the light and they couldn't find a gun, but somehow they found a gun in the dark hours
when the sun went down. Yeah,
when the sun went down. Yeah. Very, very unusual. They tested this gun for DNA, and there was no DNA from the victim on the gun, but there was DNA from two other people, a man and a woman. Now, the county, there's emails going back and forth from the woman in the lab saying, hey, do you want me to test these DNA samples to figure out, like, you know, who handled the gun? And the county writes back, no, no, don't worry about that. Don't test that. And that I've seen several cases like that. And that's just the attitude that the county has. They really don't have any interest in, you know, figuring out if their employees did something wrong or if something foul is afoot. Their approach is just to bury everything. And then, you know, once the shit starts coming out, once, you know, evidence starts coming out in these cases of these deputies, you know, having gang tattoos, admitting in depositions that, yes, I am a member of this deputy gang, then the county settles. Their move is to just throw money at the family and make it go away. That's why you see these huge payouts of $7, $8, $10 million, because they just want the problem to go away. They don't want to deal with it or address it.
I mean, to that point, I think when we talk about the way that the county has ignored or actively facilitated, I mean, ignored publicly, actively facilitated in private, the ongoing issue of this violent white supremacist culture within the LA Sheriff's Department manifesting as these myriad gangs within the department walls. One thing that has really aided them in that, it seems to me, is the difficulty in reporting on any of this. Almost all of the information and the very well-sourced information that you provide on NOC is contained within court documents, which we know, particularly when it comes to the actions of law enforcement, is oftentimes notoriously difficult to actually get. I'm curious. You mentioned they are public records. These are part of case files, but things that you've been able to procure, full depositions from deputies and stuff like that. I haven't personally seen an unredacted format or unabbreviated format before. It's really incredible. It's a testament to the work that you've done. How did you go about getting those materials, which shed so much more light on the activities of these gangs than has been previously public?
Yeah, I mean, it was really difficult just for the fact that it's so expensive. I mean, this stuff is public record, but it all costs money, right? I spent over $3,000 just trying to get this shit.
God.
So, you know, a big thank you to NOC. Like, I definitely couldn't have done it without NOC's financial backing, first and foremost. And a lot of these documents aren't available online. So during the height of, you know, COVID infections, I was going down to the courthouse where six people died of COVID to pick up these documents and, you know, bring them back to my house and going through with a highlighter and scanning them into my computer. It was a lot of work, like, definitely. Yeah.
I have a question sort of about accountability and what feels like when you read through the whole everything that's been like released so far of your project, there's a very wide range of outcomes in some of these cases. Even when it comes to settlements, you talk about these like enormous settlements, but you also mentioned settlements. There's one for $950.
Yeah.
In one of these cases. And when it comes to accountability, you talk about deputies who have testified to being in these gangs and have been associated with various wrongdoing and yet are still working or worked for a while and then retired, didn't seem to face any discipline at all. At the same time, Sheriff Lee Baca and Under Sheriff Paul Tanaka are both in prison right now, right? They're both still
yes.
in prison.
Yes.
For obstructing an FBI investigation. So is there any, to you, through line in terms of what, like how justice is administered in these cases and when accountability happens?
I mean, I'd say 9 times out of 10, it doesn't.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen, you know, harsher punishment doled out to deputies who cheat in relay races rather than deputies who, you know, rape people or kill people on the job. As far as justice is concerned, I think the only reason Lee Baca and Paul Tanaka are in jail is because they messed with the feds. And that was just one step too far. I mean, no one really cared as far as what they were doing when it was just concerned with people in Los Angeles County. The reason that they went to prison is because they messed with, you know, a federal informant. They messed with an FBI agent. That's what put them behind bars, not anything they did here.
And to, I mean, just to underline that point, one of the things that we talk about, and one of my pet projects has been the corruption on city council. And we have someone who was very recently a city council member in the city of LA, now in prison because he lied to federal investigators, not for anything he did while he was a council member, but to your point, just because he messed with a federal investigation. So I think in LA, that's representative of a problem that exists really broadly and impacts all of us in direct ways. I totally agree about the sheriff's department, just generally speaking, not facing accountability. And I'm curious, how is it that the sheriff's department, law enforcement, I think as a whole has this characteristic to an extent, but it seems like the sheriff's department is really successful at making the public at large see them as an entirely new organization every, you know, couple years. Like Hayes said, we have the two top members of two administrations ago in prison right now. But like, I feel like when you want, there is no through line for the organization. There is no way for, or there's no like currently held belief that the sheriff's department of today is the exact same as the sheriff's department of 2010 and 2000 and 1990. There, even though we know from your reporting, you know, when they broke up the Linwood Vikings, they just promoted them into other outposts, and all of those people were serving up until very recently when they retired, and now they're fly fishing or whatever. How is it that all of this continually gets swept under the rug and people don't see the LA Sheriff's Department as they continue to see these as isolated incidents instead of what you're saying, instead of a tradition within the Sheriff's Department?
I think the Sheriff's Department has a big advantage in that people aren't really familiar with the structure of the department and how it relates to the Los Angeles Police Department. Just speaking about this project with people, they generally confuse or conflate the two. Hearing people speak about the Sheriff's Department, even when they're speaking about deputies, people don't often realize that the same department that is policing you in East Los Angeles is the one that's policing you out in the Antelope Valley or in West Hollywood or in South Los Angeles. They don't really understand that it's all one department. I think that definitely plays in. I think the fact that so much of this data is anonymized in most cases, like when we're talking about deputy involved shootings, where deputies shoot people, a lot of times that information is anonymized. When we look at, you know, reports issued by the Office of the Inspector, gosh, what is his title? OIR, Office of Independent Review. When we look at those reports, all that stuff is anonymized. And it's so if a deputy does get in trouble, it's hard to figure out, like, oh, who was that? What punishment did he get? Like, and who even was that in the first place? And what did he even do? It's hard to even figure out, like, what they even did to warrant that discipline. In short, I just think the system is set up to protect them, really.
I wonder, I mean, when you bring up the structure of the department, I think that is such a salient point to this conversation. The nature of these gangs, for our listeners who are less familiar with them, is that they seem to be located geographically. People serving on the same patrol out of the same station. Cerise has an excellent article about the 3,000 boys, which is one floor of Men's Central Jail. Like that, they are very much isolated to acting out of one area. So you can have, for example, the Linwood Vikings operating out of the former Linwood station, where a deputy actually said under oath that everybody who was in that station was an inked member of this white supremacist gang. And I do think that, like, just the structure of the department and the spatial reality of Los Angeles, and the way that populations are segregated here really plays into people not being able to see how the entity functions as a whole. To that point, I mean, one of the things that you put up on, I think in one of the very first issues in your series, is about the East LA station, about the Bandidos and the history where the Bandidos evolved from the Little Devils, like the I think the first known deputy gang. Could you maybe talk about East LA's particular role in this culture of sheriff's gangs in the county?
Yeah. So East LA is the birthplace of the first deputy gang that we know about. Like you said, the Little Devils. That gang was primarily white men, and it's believed that they were present at the Chicano Moratorium, which was a protest of about 25,000 people in East Los Angeles against the Vietnam War. During that protest, hundreds of people were brutalized by sheriff's deputies, and a journalist, Ruben Salazar, was actually killed by a sheriff's deputy the night before his death. Ruben actually told a friend of his that he believed that he was being watched by the police and that he was in danger. He had been a very prominent police critic at that time. And unfortunately, his suspicions were correct and he was killed the following day. So after all that happened, the chief of the East Los Angeles station at the time began investigating, I'll say that in quotations, the Little Devils. That investigation resulted in a list of about 40 plus or minus some people that were members of the Little Devils, and they were put on a list. And as far as we know, that's the extent of the investigation. They were just put on a list. And, you know, because nothing happened, I suspect that empowered the gang and they were able to continue doing business as usual. You know, once the Little Devils were transferred out or retired, you know, these people, if they don't stay in the same station and they move, oftentimes they still are, you know, members of the gang and they still have an allegiance to the gang. in any case, once these people sort of aged out, the cavemen were the next sort of iteration of the gang that appeared at the Los Angeles station. Our current sheriff, Alex Villanueva, was working at this time. His current undersheriff, Timothy Murakami, is a tattooed member of the cavemen. Villanueva said at a recent Board of Supervisors meeting that we were all cavemen, in reference to the cavemen gang and his time in East LA.
Which I just want to interject and say that is almost the exact wording as mm-hmm. as was given for the Vikings in Glenwood.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So that tells you a lot about the culture and the influence of these gangs. So Alex was there during his time at the East Los Angeles station. He actually trained a man named Rafael Munoz, who goes by the name Big Listo. And he is a shot caller of the Banditos. So, you know, there you have again the tradition being passed from one generation to the next. And that's how I've seen this carried out, you know, at most stations. There will be, you know, an older generation of the gang who sort of passes the torch on to the younger, newer ones that are coming in. I think, you know, this culture is also really helped along by the fact that all these deputies start out in a jail assignment, right? And a lot of times that is at Men's Central Jail, which is the home of the 3000 boys. So they're coming out of the academy. They're being put in this environment, which, you know, we know is run by this very violent deputy gang. And they're trained by those people. And then they're put out on the streets where they're being greeted by these men that have been participating in these deputy gangs for decades. And they've been promoted and they've been decorated and received accolades for the department, and that's who's training them and showing them the ropes of how to do police work. And it really just reinforces everything.
I feel like one of the things that was really striking to me, I think this was a photo that you got from LAist, but it was really striking to me to see a recent picture of the East LA station with the Fort Apache branding and the logo, which you also pulled a picture of Alex Villanueva with that same iconography in his office as sheriff. It's really telling, I think, how the deputies and how the sheriff's department see themselves. Again, when we go back to the idea of the structure of the department, you talked about the Fort Apache being this movie that was about the sort of like white man in the savage land, basically, and attacking indigenous people. That is a self-identification out of East LA Station, and it persists to this day with apparently the imprimatur of the highest ranking official in the department. Is there, to your knowledge, are there other stations that have those sorts of self-identifications, anything like that, that is publicly known in the way that Fort Apache is? I assume there's nothing for West Hollywood, for example.
I think Fort Apache is probably the most popular, if there are other symbols that have that same sort of notoriety. It's not quite known to me at this point. I think probably a similar one would be the Century Station logo, I would say. And I've heard and read in depositions that that's been incorporated into some deputy tattoos that are members in the gang. But I think Fort Apache is probably the most popular. They seem to really like that one. I actually just purchased one thing that I've been doing in the course of my research is purchasing paraphernalia of these deputy gangs. So I've acquired patches, some lovely decorative wall art, all with deputy gang logos. And one of the things that I recently purchased was this woodwork, Blue Lives Matter flag with the Fort Apache logo, where the stars and stripes go. So, yeah, there's a thriving marketplace.
It's like an Etsy workshop. Yeah.
I did find it on Etsy, actually, Alyssa. No, yes.
No. I mean, yeah. We definitely are eagerly looking forward. We're eagerly looking forward to the remaining stories in this series, which seems like it is acquiring an ongoing character. So
I ask one more question. I'm just kind of like here. I would love to connect this series to like your experience as a journalist. The last time we've talked about it before, like you have you have worked at larger media outlets in different capacities as a freelancer, as a full-time employee. I've spoken to a journalist who has suffered from police violence and has felt like since then attention from employers and things like that when it comes to reporting on policing because of their experiences. For you, you're moving into a place where like this is reporting with essentially like the way you communicate. It's with a point of view. It's reporting that I assume you feel like you couldn't do at some of these other outlets. Can you talk about like whether that's like a transition for you, like a deliberate choice, and like your kind of experiences between traditional and independent media?
I think that. Oh gosh, I have a lot to say about that. I'm just trying to think of like how to organize it in the best way.
I know, it's like, and as we were like wrapping up, it's very annoying to ask. It's a big question, but
yeah. Let's see. So going into this project, I didn't really have a point of view per se of like abolish the sheriff's department or anything like that, and. You know, I have my own personal views, but, you know, writing about this, I approach all of my stories that I do, which is delivering the facts free of whatever it is that I think. And that's how I've reported this piece. The reason that I did it at an independent media outlet like Knock is because, you know, frankly, big media outlets don't want to do this story. Big media outlets like the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, they've known about this story longer than I've been alive. They've known about this stuff at least since the 1980s. I think with the Los Angeles Times, we could even indict them as far back as the 1970s. And this story was never done. They've had I'm the only reporter on this piece, which is, you know, not to toot my own horn, but that's an incredible fucking feat. Like this is the stuff that you would expect like the spotlight team to take on. Mm-hmm. The fact that it was just me is incredible. And I will probably be in intensive therapy for years as a result of that. Knock also doesn't have the resources of a large newsroom, which is something that I think we need to highlight. The fact that an independent news outlet that is funded by donations took on a project with this price tag is, again, an incredible feat. And it's still ongoing. And I feel like it probably will drive Knock into bankruptcy. But it's something that, you know, they're happy to do because it's public service journalism. The reason I think that big media outlets didn't want to do this is because, one, it concerns Black and brown people, and they are low-income people. And frankly, that's a community that major media outlets don't want to invest in. I've had meetings with people from both of those publications and other publications that have just told me, frankly, that because people in those neighborhoods don't subscribe to the paper, don't buy the paper, they aren't interested in reporting on those neighborhoods, which I think is fucked up. Just simply stated, it's fucked up.
I mean, when you're, you know, just to say, like, when you're talking about the LA Times in particular, this is an organization that quite possibly had a prominent reporter from their own pages assassinated by
yes.
this by this organization. So it
and
is.
And yet,
yeah,
no coverage was all. I mean, there was coverage done, but you know, most of the coverage that we see on these, on the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department or on the deputy gangs, is taken straight from the press releases of the department. Which I don't know how you can call that journalism. Mm-hmm. I really don't. Like, I spent way too much money that I don't have on getting a journalism degree. And I'm pretty sure that they told us, like, day one that that's not what you do. Yeah, so I took this to an independent media outlet because, one, they were willing to take a chance on me, which, you know, most major media outlets don't want to hire a gay Black woman. That's just what it is. And they really don't want to hire a gay Black woman whose goal it is to do a tell-all about one of the biggest law enforcement agencies in the country. That's just not something that they want to do. And for whatever reason, I've had editors tell me that I don't have enough writing experience to do a project of this ilk. I've had people tell me that, you know, I haven't been doing journalism long enough. I've been doing journalism more than 10 years of my life. I wonder when I will finally be qualified enough to actually do my fucking job to some of these people. So, yeah, I mean, I can go on and rant about, you know, the treatment that I've had from major media outlets and why that drove me to do this. But I mean, it's for a lot of the same reasons that we talked about the last time I was here.
I would just want to say, I mean, well, there's a lot I want to say. I want to say, first of all, just like how appreciative we are that you undertook this project and to knock for having the courage to publish it as well, because obviously that does take courage, clearly, based on the responses of other organizations. I feel like it can't be stated enough when you look at the types of responses that you're getting, all of the reasons not to publish something like this, all of the reasons not to undertake a project like this, whether it's the cost, whether it's that you don't really care about the communities impacted, whether it's you know, that you just don't want to risk the institutional ire of the police.
Or that you think that the Black person who's been experiencing this violence isn't qualified enough to tell the story.
Or that you don't believe in the qualifications.
This is, or is too biased, too connected to it, like those things. Yeah.
What I want to say is, like, when you look at all of those reasons, that is so restrictive that's the reason why we've had 50 years of this and never had a piece of writing like this published. So, I mean, to you, I mean, I just have gratitude that you didn't let that sort of thing stop, not that you would, but that you didn't let that kind of thing stop you, because the result is now we have a lot of things documented that were not previously widely available. And so I don't know, to me that's what this type of journalism is all about, is finding ways and reasons to get information that the public needs to have at their fingers out there.
Public service.
Yes. So
that's why we're supposed to do this.
Right. So
Just to Knock's credit, and it's been so clear over the last week, and to see the treatment of their journalists who are, you know, the LA Times reporters got released right away once they figured out who they were, even though the journalists were targeted. But it's harder to convince them that other outlets are, you know, just as legitimate and should be treated that way. So this, I mean, what Knock has done with your piece, with your series and the coverage of the last week, is just to start something new is just really phenomenal. And I just want to give them so much credit and appreciation for giving you all the space to report the stories in the way that you want to do them. So it's a big deal.
And, you know, to that point, I just want to say, I don't think it's a coincidence that Jonathan Peltz, who was my very dedicated research assistant on this project, I don't think it was a coincidence that he was arrested and held for hours without any of us knowing where the hell he was the week that this story came out. I really don't think that's a coincidence. Just want to put that out there.
Can you maybe tip for us anything that we can expect to see apart from what you said at the beginning in the next coming installments of the series.
Yeah, and the next coming installments of the end series, this goes up Monday, right?
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Or, yeah, so starting today, we'll have the second part of the 3,000 Boys, which gets into how the culture of the 3,000 Boys was able to be spread around the department after the departure of Lee Baca and Paul Tanaka. And then we'll get into the newer generations of deputy gangs. These are the people that are out on the streets still today, terrorizing people throughout the county.
Therese, thank you so much.
Therese, thank you again for joining us. Thank you to Brian Holmes for producing the show. Thank you to everyone for listening. We'll be back next week. Bye-bye.